traditional sense, and we knew this. You know, so it was up to us, we thought, to decide what that role would be.
Say something about, or a lesson that we can take from the 1969 Wall Street takeover that's applicable to us today.
Yeah.
Sir?
Before the actual takeover in 1969, what defeated the AAS and I guess the sound of the white SCS cooperative? I mean, before things actually left, did they cooperate or not?
There was a considerable degree of cooperation. We had an Ithaca housing project, which was argued long and hard, that wasn't completely understood or accepted on certain levels, but trying to develop housing for the community elements that couldn't afford decent housing at the time. It wasn't always amicable. There was some distrust, but the unfortunate thing then was that some of us had been around since the early stages of the black student arrival in any significant numbers. We're speaking now, you know, a dozen, whatever. And we had friendships that predated our politicization. And the friendships were crucial toward developing and maintaining rapport and political struggles. It was always tricky, and, you know, one had to stand one's ground no matter what happened. I mean, there were times when black students thought we should do things as an organization, i.e. Students for Democratic Society, that we didn't think we should do, like Occupy Bay Hall at a given moment in sympathy with their struggle or whatever. And we would argue these things out at a bar called Julio's down on Meadow Street, which was a predominantly black bar, working class establishment, and people, normal patrons, would look at us like we were all sort of nuts over there, jabbering away about Marx, Lenin, Mao, Nkrumah and stuff, and it worked. But again, those things were and are very tricky, because whenever you disagree and there's a possibility of for example, and this isn't the only way it goes, a black person saying you're disagreeing because you're a racist, you got to deal with that up front. You got to be able to explain that that's not the question. And you remember how many times that happened, Ruben, right?
I think those of us who came in the earlier years, we knew Dave, we knew Chip Marshall, we knew Joe Kelly. The guy who went to jail in Syracuse for not going to Vietnam.
Bruce Stances.
We knew these people were sincere. We didn't always agree with them, but we respected their consciousness. And I think it did become more manipulative when the lines got drawn. And I think even in our community, there was some mistrust of those of us who maintained those relationships. As maybe being a point of vulnerability for us, which I think was basic insecurity. You either know who you are or you don't. But I think for the most part, we respected members of SDS. Some of them were crazy, and some in our group were just outright crazy. But, I think that we understood that this was a group that would support us, and that we could turn.
A concluding comment from each speaker, Mr. Monday.
I had environment. I think I've said most. I guess maybe if I could have chosen my topic, I would have talked about where I think the movement is now, the black movement, because here we are now, and. I think that we are struggling politically in the cities now. I think that we have matured, and I think one reason the movement is more quiet now, I think, it's not the students' fault, I don't think, but full recognition of the problem is more apparent now, I think, than it was at the time, because things that could be accomplished were accomplished, and the question is still open on certain things. In Detroit right now, my major business is municipal finance. We broker federal incentives to private investors to get them to invest in the city of Detroit to build the economic base. It's an very delicate balance between black political power and white economic power. And in that process, there are certain financial incentives like tax-exempt finance and like urban development action grants that are not available to private developers except through the municipality. So when we broker these deals, we make sure that black firms benefit from these deals. We make sure that residents of Detroit, not just people from Farmington or Troy, come into Detroit, exploit Detroit, and then go home to their suburban neighborhood. So in the early 60s, it would have been amazing enough to have a Coleman Young in Detroit or Harold Washington in Chicago. Now, we're in the house. The black people outside are ticked off with me. The black people outside are ticked off with other black people about policy decisions that hurt some people and help other people. Good and bad, fair and unfair. These are very difficult notions. But we've come a long way, and I'm grateful to Cornell for giving me the strength and what skill I have. And I intend to go forward to do the best I can so that people can make progress and live in peace in a decent way. Thank you.
I'm scared to make an old-fashioned political speech and say we should all get out and vote out the President of the United States. He is as successful as he is because, like many characters in Joseph Conrad, he has no imagination.
And Mr. David Burek, who will make an announcement after his concluding comments.
Now for 20-minute comment? No. One of the announcements is there'll be a reception immediately following, which is set up over there with some wine, crackers, and cheese. And anybody that has questions and didn't get an answer or comments that they'd like to make to any of us, please feel free to do so. Now, this is not intended to be humorous, although I know that it will sound somewhat like that, but in all honesty, one, to understand SDS at the time of the Strait takeover and that year before and after was an incredibly intense and large student organization with some faculty membership. There was over 150 people regularly active, and many meetings would have about 300. Rubin's statement about SDS providing the guns is interesting because it's the first time I've heard it stated publicly. Up to this point, I have never heard it but in rumor. Again, I know some, you never heard it either, David? Good. Peter was here then, active, there's substantiation for it. I didn't know about it, and it was kept from me. A lot of the things, as I say, I was in the middle. And literally, you know, I know some people that say, ah, look at him, wash my hands of this one. But people kept things from me because they didn't want me yelling at them. I mean, back then, we had some members, one of them, I will not mention his name, he was 17, you know, and I mean, I was 22, so I was the big daddy in that operation. And he would have the craziest notion. Sometimes we'd have a party that would be going on at 2:30, full swing, and he'd call the whole steering committee in the bathroom and say, we've got to go up and take over Day Hall now. It's a prime time. Nobody's expecting it. I know everybody here in the party will follow us, and we'll get on the phones. We'll have 100 people in there by morning. I say, Jeff, nuts. Please. I said, what are you? You've been drinking a little too much. What's in the punch? In any case, it was not done out of any funds, organizational funds. The second point I want to make is, and it's entitled in the announcement, which may seem anomalous, but as this period unfolds itself, this period of now the mid-80s, where political activism, humanitarian causes ranging from anti-nuclear and environmental to the different liberation, sexual and otherwise, get off the ground again, become possible mass movements. I hope everybody keeps in mind how much of their humanity is also involved in the apolitical and non-political fronts. Because that's one of the things that many people lost sight of in the late 60s, and what created or contributed to the monomania of people in organizations like the Weathermen. And I mean monomania like Captain Ahab had, and they use that metaphor too, interestingly enough, do everything to kill the white whale of imperialism or anything else. David Drinkwater remembers this discussion after a sermon of his where he talked about Ahab. And many radicals in the 60s became like Ahab. They were willing to take down the ship and the crew and everybody involved as long as they could get what they thought had hurt them. Don't do that. And poetry has been to me one of the saving graces, and I referred to people like Jim McConkie in fiction, Archie Ammons in poetry as lifeguards, or fishermen in a rowboat that's helped pull me out of a stormy sea. And I would like to invite you all to the next production of the Theater of Ideas, which will be next Wednesday, the 7th of March, in this room. There'll be a poetry reading by Frederick Morgan, whose aesthetic sensibilities have come under some scrutiny recently by friends I respect, but I believe he gives a marvelous reading, and it will be at 8 p.m. here in the Memorial Room Wednesday the 7th of March. And though I know many of you aren't as interested in poetry as you are in politics, you might find it worth your while. Now, I'd just also like to thank personally, again, Andrew Hall and T.J. Costello and the IFC people made this possible, Katrina Hazer from Mujama, who was willing to co-sponsor, Glenn George for the Sigma Phi Elephant Fellowship, Chris Corden, the Lewis Strait Program Board, for the work they've done and the help they've given, and Ruby Sackley for coming through at a last minute almost, you know, a past midnight phone call, so to speak, to do the moderating. I think she added a very definite quality to this event. And most importantly, I would like to thank all of you for coming and staying as long as you did. I know it's not the easiest thing to do, and I hope we can keep in touch and keep things going. Thanks again.